Let's call the House, the Joint House Committee, Transportation Committee together. It is 1 minute after one, and because we have three different groups that want to testify today, we're going to get going right away, and as the rest of them come in, we'll kind of let them straggle in, I guess. It's a privilege again to meet jointly with the Senate Transportation Committee. And Senator Kukesh, would you like to introduce your Senate members? And if you know that there's some that's going to be coming in shortly, you could mention them too.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate you all being here. We have all of the Senate members right here, I'll have you know. Senator Huggins, Senator Menard, Senator Thomas, Senator Dennis Egan, and myself, Senator Kukesh. I appreciate you all being here, Senators, and appreciate your time today. Thank you, Peggy, for chairing the meeting.
Okay. And also let the record reflect that the House members that are here today are Representative Feige and myself, Representative Wilson, and we'll introduce the other ones as they come in. And I would like to recognize the staff today. Over in this corner is Nancy Hemingway, who is our House Recording Secretary. And on this side is Ryan Wilson, no relation, but he's our LIO moderator. And my committee aide is Becky Rooney. And the Senate committee aide is Nancy Barnes. I'm just trying to see if I can see her. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones. And not just to vibrate, but all the way off. And we're going to continue our overviews today to hear to help us prepare for the bills that we're going to be hearing later on in the session. And first, we're going to hear from the Kinnick Arm Bridge Authority, and or Catawba, followed by the Mobility Coalition, and finally the Port McKenzie Rail Extension. And we only have an hour and 45 minutes, and so I'm going to be kind of mean and cut people off after 35 minutes. And so what we'll do to try to help that along a little bit is we won't ask questions until the end, and then hopefully we'll have some time so that legislators can ask questions afterwards. And I'm going to strictly adhere to that time limit. So without further ado, let's go ahead. And we have the CEO, Kevin Hemingway, from Catawba, and also the chairman of the board, Michael Foster.
Before we start, if you would, I've asked Senator Egan, we've had a discussion, he's going to have to leave after 15 minutes, so just want to recognize that he'd be leaving. He's not got another committee conflict.
Yeah, there's several of us that have that kind of a conflict. The month of February, that will happen because of our finance subcommittee hearings. So, okay, without further ado, and then if one stops speaking and the other one starts, make sure you mention your name each time so that our recording secretary, when she types it up, she'll know which one's talking. So go ahead and state your name and your affiliation.
I'm Michael Foster. I'm the chair of the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority, Catawba, and I have with me Kevin Hemingway, who is our chief financial officer. And we gave this presentation to the Joint Committee last summer. Since that time frame, there's been two milestone events on this project. One is a no jeopardy determination related to the beluga listing and the impacts of this project on the belugas. And then we received a record of decision from the Federal Highways in mid-December with a build alternative, basically marching orders to go forward and build the project. I'll go through the presentation relatively quickly because I know you got a busy schedule today, and then hopefully we'll have some time to answer questions at the end. I believe you all have packets that we sent down either Friday or Monday. Why is the Kinnick Arm Bridge good for Alaska? Connects Alaska's infrastructure, supports resource development, provides jobs, and supports economic growth. It's an alternative corridor for safety. Currently, the only corridor north out of Anchorage is the Glenn Highway. This would provide another corridor out of Anchorage for safety. And it helps fund future transportation projects. And I'll go into that in more detail later, but transportation projects statewide, the toll revenue from this can be used for any Title 23 type project from Ketchikan to Barrow to Dutch Harbor for roads, harbors, marine highways, boardwalks, some limitations on airports, and also on highways. The immediate benefits, it's what I call a true economic stimulus. I'll go into a little bit about the financing of this. It is a public-private partnership that we're pursuing. The capital for this project is put up by a private party investor. There is a partnership between the state and this investor, but the money that comes forward on this to construct this actually comes out of the private sector. $700 million, about 5,000 direct jobs. It takes about 3 to 4 years to complete this project. Look at indirect jobs, about 5,000, so about 10,000 individuals can rely on this project over the next 3 or 4 years. Public benefit, $326 million, cost savings over 10 years for freight alone going north out of the Port of Anchorage. Instead of coming through Anchorage down the Glen Highway around the Wasilla, this will now allow freight coming into the Port of Anchorage to go directly north across the bridge, tying into the Parks Highway and on into the interior. That number represents labor savings and fuel savings. Capitalization of assets and stuff is not included, so the number can actually be larger than that. $303 million savings just to commuters. About half of that is fuel. The other half is time savings. So one's kind of a tangible asset or tangible savings. The other one's kind of an intangible, but there's about $150 million in fuel savings for commuters using the bridge. And I'll point out later, the correction facility that's being constructed by the state is 75 miles roughly from there to the court system in Anchorage. With a bridge in place, it's only 12 miles. About 2 million metric tons of carbon emissions reduction. That's about what the Ship Creek power plant puts out on an annual basis. So it's also has a green benefit for carbon reduction. $30 million savings to the Goose Creek correctional facility, and that is related to transportation of staff, vendors, and supplies to run the correction facility. It does not include visitors and savings to them. Connects another alternative to the Glen Highway. As I mentioned earlier, those of us who live in Anchorage or even live north of Anchorage realize that the only connection in and out is the Glen Highway. It's closed about once a month on an average. It's closed about once a week for delays, and if you're on it today, you would experience that with the snow and the traffic. Connects Port of Anchorage and Port McKenzie to better serve the state. Ties together state transportation needs. Traffic model, this is based on the information that we have. Is based on third-party consultants, our models, third-party consultants, DOT's review, Federal Highways oversight. We believe in this model. We think this model is a fair representation of what we will see with the Kinnickarm Crossing built. It assumes a 2015 opening. The red represents commercial, the blue represents commuters, passenger traffic. If you notice at the very top, it goes flat. That's where the bridge basically reaches capacity as a four-lane structure at that point. That's the maximum capacity. We also know from the Glen Highway and others that you can keep adding to that capacity, but it just chokes it. Next slide is, as you know, this is a toll authority. It is a public-private partnership. There is revenue generated from this. Based on the previous slide, based on the traffic model that we have, over a 60-year time frame, and I've been asked questions, why isn't there any traffic in the first 4 years of this? If you look at the graph, it's a 60-year model, but the first 4 years is the construction of the facility. So it doesn't open until 2015. Based on the traffic model, based on the revenue stream, it's $12.1 billion of gross revenue that is earned through tolls. How does this toll get, how the gross revenue get distributed? As I said earlier, we have a public-private partnership process, so we will have a private partner who will put up the capital to build this project. And it's called an availability payment structure. So I kind of will use the analogy. It's kind of like building a high rise. In the initial year, you have a lease payment, and availability payment is very similar to what you would consider to be a lease payment. So the revenue, gross revenue comes out. It pays the private partner an availability fee payment. Then what comes next is the operating cost for Kubota, and then the reserve replenishment, project improvements, and other transportation needs. The reserve replenishment is revenue that rolls back into the state, rolls back into Title 23 services. Project improvements is when the at a certain point, we estimate about 10 years into the project, the Ingra-Gamble connection will be built through project funds. So initially, the bridge is a four-lane structure. However, the deck and stuff in the initial years is only two lanes. When traffic demands, it will go to four lanes. The road prisms, the embankments are all built for a four-lane structure. However, in the initial years, it's not required to have it. So it's about year 10 into the project that four lanes and then Ingram-Gamble connection is required.
Let the record show that Representative Pruitt, Representative Munoz, and Representative Peterson have joined us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, the next slide is projected net revenue. And, you know, to me, this is the one that kind of tells the whole story. It's the green is net revenue. You could call it profit if you're in the private sector. The red is the availability payments. It's based on a 35-year model for our private partner. The blue represents the operating cost of the facility after the P3 contractual relationship is done. It doesn't mean that you won't. It doesn't mean it's not possible to continue that concession. But certainly the model we have is based on this first 35 years. The green is what would roll back into other transportation needs. The blue over there represents the money that it would take to for operation and maintenance, improvements, expansions required, the Ingram-Gamble. The green represents the net revenue that could be used for transportation statewide. And it represents about $8 billion in net revenue over a 60-year life. The next slide shows the location of the crossing. There's been questions, why don't we cross earlier? The idea is to cross up inlet from Port McKenzie. We also have some airspace constraints with Elmendorf with their flight line. This is also geologically a very good location to cross that we're on, and we have a slide that will show the called the Karn trough through there, the actual facility. The bridge crossing itself sits on consolidated till. It is not on bootlegger clay or mud, so it actually sits on a very, very hard, firm foundation, and this is the ideal location for that. Next, we have a few slides. If you could look at the overhead, you can actually, we have some animated slides that will actually show one, the tidal influence, the bathymetry, and then we show a construction sequence, and at the end we show what it would look like when it's constructed. And this is coming up the inlet. You'll see the trough or the trench that I talked about. Anchorage is to your right, Port McKenzie is to your left. This is when the inlet's empty. That's the location of the bridge. This was tide. The crossing is 14,000 feet. The bridge is right now at about 8,200 feet. We have about 6,000 feet of embankment on either side. This is season one. People have asked about how tall this bridge is. We have a Coast Guard requirement. At high tide, we have to have 50 feet of clearance. At low tide, we're about between 75 and 80 feet, depending on the tides. The technology for this, one of the mitigations for the belugas is noise impacts. This is an oscillated drill shaft. These are 8-10-foot diameter shafts. They're basically augered in or screwed in. They have a cutting bit on the end, and then you bale them out, put your cage and fill them with concrete. Very low noise impact related to versus a driven pile. The state recently did this kind of construction for the Tanawha crossing on the Tok Highway. This is season two. You can see some of the piles and some of the caps coming across. They're still working in mid-span. This is what it looks like before the deck goes on, so all the foundation's in place. And again, it's foundation for a four-lane with pedestrian and bike. Yeah, it's about a 14,000. Well, actually, the crossing there is 8,200 feet for the piles, about 14,000 foot crossing. This is after the bridge is built out to a full four lane. Elmendorf property is to your left. The alignment hugs the back of the port, so and this shows actually the port expansion being built out. Hugs the back of the port. It goes through a cut and bury tunnel on Government Hill, which has a green belt on top of it. And that is a summary. I hope I have left ample opportunity for questions and answers.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is going to be the toll to cross this? And is, I mean, how many years before you project there'll be at, you know, break even to make the minimum payments on the bridge?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, the initial toll is set up as $5 for passenger vehicle, and that's each way. And then semi-tractor is based on axles, number of axles, or weight. We actually expect within year two or three that the toll revenue will exceed the availability payment requirements. However, we do understand the first 5 years, and you will see some legislation this year for the reserve fund funding. We have the reserve fund ability. We need to fund that, and that reserve fund is so that we can cover those initial years when revenue will be less than the availability payment.
Okay.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how do you plan to convince the residents of Government Hill to allow this project to go forward, because I've heard that there's been a lot of comments by members that live in that area about the building of this project.
Through the chair, Representative, the initially it was just a cut, an open cut. A lid was placed on it, and we have some graphics of what a lid would look like with a green belt on top. The initial, the Government Hill cut of it requires three properties in order to build it. At the end of this, I believe, and I can't, I'm not a Government Hill resident, so it's hard for me to say it's not going to have any impact, but I believe we have minimized the impacts the best we can with the cut and bury tunnel and the green belt on top of it.
Senator Menard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, for those of you that don't know, Mr. Foster here, remember the zinc mine, the Red Dog, which is the largest zinc mine in the world. He was the engineer on this project, and I have said over and over, your project's only as good as sometimes the people that are driving it. So kudos to Mike, and they've worked so hard for all the information they've given you. They're currently working on a reserve fund and a bill to come forward, and I think you've touched on that a little bit, but would you also kind of toot Kevin's horn and his financial awards that he's received at this time.
Let me touch on the reserve fund, and then I'll praise our chief financial officer. The reserve fund, as Senator Menard mentioned, is a bill that I believe Senator Menard and Representative Newman are bringing forward. And that is a bill to fund the reserve fund so that we have operating money in the initial years of the project for availability payments. If the reserve fund is funded this year, funds from the reserve fund aren't required for another 5 or 6 years. The first time the reserve fund would be needed at all is when the first availability payment is made, which is after the structure is completed and open for traffic. The revenue, we believe, at about year three, the total revenue will then be paying back that reserve fund. And at some point, we believe within the first 5 or 6 years, any money taken from the reserve fund after opening will be completely repaid, and excess revenue, as we indicated in one of those graphs, will then go into that fund and then used for other Title 23 services statewide. So that's kind of the mechanism of the reserve fund. It isn't needed for 5 or 6 years. We need it funded now in order to go to market for our private partner. We have to show them that we have funds available for the availability payments in the initial years, because that's when things are tight. And just like building a high rise, your initial years, you know, you usually don't have it full. So let me go ahead. And Kevin Hemingway is our chief financial officer, without his support, guidance, and financial astute, I'd be up here just throwing numbers at you. But let me ask Kevin to give you a few words on the reserve fund also.
Okay. Well, of course, the main reason for this is Kevin Hemingway. The main reason for the purpose of the reserve fund is it enhances the credit of the project, which allows the private sector to make a lower availability payment bid. The bids will be the lowest availability payment between the competing parties. And the objective, of course, is to get the most value for the public and the citizens of Alaska out of the transaction. Senator Menard asked me to give a little bit of background about myself. I have about a 30-year career in the private sector in public accountancy and finance. I've been the chief financial officer of two different publicly traded corporations, including Alaska Communication Systems, which is what brought me to Alaska back in 1999. And I've completed several billion dollars worth of financial transactions in my life. What's attracting me to this project is we really need it here in Alaska, and I'd like to have an opportunity for my kids to come back and have the same opportunities that I had up here in my career.
Kevin, this fund and this bill that you're talking about, is it going to be a certain amount of money that you think you're going to need to have in a fund, or is it just going to be something, if you need the money, we'll give it to you? I mean, I don't understand for sure how that's going to work.
We think it's important for the private sector to see that money has been appropriated to it as much as it is to establish the fund. There's really two parts of the bill language. The other piece is if you do draw it and it drops below a certain level, which will be determined through the contractual procurement, that would be subject to appropriation for replenishment if it happened to draw down below that level. And that's pretty standard backstop credit enhancement. Going back to the graphics where you saw the availability payment followed by the lower level of operating costs once the state takes it back over, the other thing that this does for us is, since we can get the transaction at a lower cost of capital, the state can get back the ownership of the full revenue other than operations and maintenance by about year 35 after substantial completion, instead of 50 or 60 years out, which would probably be what would be needed if we didn't have some form of credit enhancement, because the private sector would have a higher cost of capital, higher borrowing rate, higher equity expectation.
Okay, Representative Feige has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Sort of an engineering question. Just going back to your slide that has the plan view of the project. Nick Arms got quite a bit of tidal flow back and forth, and What have your engineers said about once this bridge gets put in place, what are the depositional characteristics going to be? Because you've got basically two abutments on either end of the bridge that are going to project out into the flow, the water flow of Kinnick Arm, and with the high sediment load, you're going to end up with deposition. I'm looking at Port McKenzie. What's that going to do to the dredging requirements? What's that going to do to the ability of ships to maneuver within this area? I mean, we're already having problems with a shoal that's encroaching on the Port of Anchorage that may or may not be due to Port McKenzie being constructed. What's your best guess?
Through the chair, you're probably aware that the Corps has a model of Cook Inlet at their hydraulic lab, and we have been down there with the Port of Anchorage and the Port McKenzie to study the effects of this structure, the expansion of the Port of Anchorage and expansion of Port McKenzie too. There is a possibility working with the Corps that our total bridge span may increase in order to minimize deposition, but it's still being modeled. We're still in that process of modeling, fine-tuning it. At this point, the model that we ran about 3 months ago didn't show that the bridge would have an impact on either of the ports. That's still up for discussion. There's concerns from both the City of Anchorage and the Matsu Borough on would this have additional dredging needs. And so we also have a request from National Marine Fisheries Services to look at expanding also the bridge structure and having less fill. So we're kind of weighing all the different, from engineering's perspective, we're weighing all the different parameters to come up with the optimum design. One, to mitigate impacts to the belugas, also to mitigate sediment deposits or additional dredging concerns.
Okay, thanks very much.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I appreciate Representative Feige's question. That was one of mine. Regarding the public-private partnership, and we're a little squeezed for time, I would like to have maybe a better understanding of how that's anticipated to work. Like I said, we're squeezed for time now. If we only have a few minutes, and I had a couple of other questions that you may, I don't know if the rest of the committee is interested in them or not, but I certainly am, and how that's put together, how that works. I understand the upfront aspect of the state looking like they're involved. I certainly agree with that. I'm a big project kind of person myself, and I don't mind the state taking a lead and putting money into something, but I'd like to see a little bit more on how that private partnership, public-private partnership works out. And another question, I usually find that the costs are underestimated and the benefits are overestimated, and we don't know that until the project is either under construction or constructed. And if there are overruns, it would be interesting to me to know how those overruns reflect on the partnership and who ponies up the overruns. And then Representative Peterson asked about the break-even point, but what are the components or what causes the increased traffic flow over the period of time? Is it just people getting more interested in driving that fashion, or is there some population estimates that create over a 25-year period? What goes into your curve?
Through the chair, I'll let Mr. Hemingway discuss the P3. He's the most familiar with that process.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is Kevin Hemingway. The way the public-private partnership would work is the state would retain the ownership of the toll revenue. The toll revenue would be used to make those availability payments to the private partner. The procurement for that private partner is the minimum availability payment and an otherwise compliant proposal. The functions that the private partner would carry out in the project is to design, build, finance, operate, and maintain the facility over the term of the concession to certain performance standards that are contractually set. One of those performance standards is building to the technical specifications and operating and maintaining to the technical specifications. And the vast majority of construction-related risk is laid off onto the private partner within the in the contract, and they have, you know, you establish delivery terms and things, which is, you know, our constructability reviews indicate 3 to 4 years to construct, and they'll need that time to get it done. But if they are late in delivering, you would have penalties on the availability payment. If the roadway is not maintained to a standard, there's penalties on the availability payment. So the bid they make is the maximum availability payment, assuming that they're meeting their contractual obligations. At the end of the term of the private partnership, they also have handback requirements of what condition the facility gets handed back to the state in. And typically, you're shooting for about an 80% of new, very well-maintained facility. And what the private partners, of course, are working on is the profit motive, so they want to be very efficient. And the teeth that we have in it is the contractual performance standards that are set for what they construct and how it will be operated and maintained. There are certain kinds of risks they won't lay off, like archaeopaleo, for example. But if it's a construction cost overrun with their design-build subcontractor, that's typically laid on to the private partner unless for some reason it's caused by Kubota or the state. Now, if you had one other question, and I'm
traffic.
Traffic. There's a number of components that go into the traffic and revenue study. We hired, you saw in the logo there, Wilbur Smith Associates. Wilbur Smith Associates was selected because they are one of the best in the industry. Out of 20 greenfield or startup toll roads that they've done over the last, say, 10 years roughly, they've averaged about 96% of their base case traffic. So it's been very well, very highly accurate. Now, there has been some outliers, but only one project ended up more than or below 75% of their base case traffic out of those 20 projects. Wilbur Smith does what they call an investment grade traffic and toll revenue study. That's a study that is that rating agencies and investors use in Wall Street to decide whether or not to invest in a project. So this is a very high quality traffic and revenue study, and it's the kind of thing that we also have them periodically bring up to snuff. One of the big drivers in it is population growth. There's a number of different population forecasts out there that indicate the region is going to have a population growth over roughly the next 20 years of between 150 and 250,000 approximately. So the main, I guess, public policy thesis for this project is to accommodate population growth in the region as well as the movement of people and freight and open up economic opportunities for the state.
Representative Peterson, you have a question. We've got 1 minute left yet.
Oh, do you have someone? No.
Okay, thank you. Now, Kubota was created with a grant of federal funds, as I recall. And how much was that original grant, and how much do you still have left?
Through the chair, it was there was a federal appropriation for the project. And I don't have those numbers in front of me. Roughly, it was a little over $200 million. About $100 million of that was reappropriated by Governor Murkowski to other public projects. About $110 million stayed with Kubota. We have about $65 million that still remains more than adequate for us to get through the final permits, the solicitation for a public-private, and our operating costs. The reserve fund we're looking at is strictly for the availability, not for the operation of Kubota.
Okay, and one more question I have is, so how much is, in the bill that's coming up this year before this body, how much are you asking for?
$150 million.
Okay, thank you. And I'm sorry, we don't have enough time to do the rest, but if you can get with these gentlemen, I'm going to take a brief at ease. Please, no one leave, because we're just going to let the next groups set up. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, the next thing that we're going to hear, the next group that we're going to hear for from is the Alaska Mobility Coalition, and I understand we have three presenters, David Levy of the Coalition, Bill Herman of the Mental Health Trust Authority, and Jeff Otteson with DOT. So please state your name, and I see a lady up here, so are you just turning the pages?
I could do that. I'll have some brief comments,
okay.
Very brief.
Okay. So go ahead and make sure when we switch people that we state your name and affiliation. So proceed.
Madam Chair, Senator Kokesh, Senate and House Transportation Committee members, ladies and gentlemen, my name is David Levy, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Mobility Coalition. And to my left is Jennifer Beckman, who is the President of the Board of Directors of the Coalition, as well as the Executive Director of Central Area Rural Transit, which is on the Kenai. I want to thank you for this opportunity to talk to you today. We have three items we wanted to go over with you today. One is what we're about, what the Mobility Coalition is about. Talk to you a little bit about our Going Is Good public awareness campaign, which we started last year about this time, and give you kind of a flavor of what some of the issues are around public and community transportation around Alaska, and then talk about our two legislative priorities for the current session. Next one. Great. So, as I said, we're going to talk about our What is AMC, our Going Is Good campaign, and our legislative priorities. And that, just a second. That's a newspaper ad that was in the Daily News several years ago. There was in Anchorage a lot of discussion about the number of empty buses, or what people perceive to be a lot of empty buses in Anchorage. And the Daily News article reminds folks that there are also a lot of empty cars that follow those buses. So they added that in there for folks to take a look at. The Alaska Mobility Coalition is a private nonprofit membership organization. We represent and advocate for public and community transportation statewide. We've been around since 2002. As I said, we're a representative organization. We provide folks with weekly updates of transportation issues around the state, a monthly newsletter, which is available on the web, our annual report, which kind of identifies transportation issues, our website, which updates folks, and then to be in the age of social media, we also have a Facebook page. And the photo you'll see coming up here is an example of a cooperative arrangement between the bus, which is in Ketchikan, and the ferry system that comes in. That's one of the big boats that come in.
Ferry.
This is an example of our membership. We have nearly 100 members across the state, from AARP the last one is VPSI in Anchorage. We have representation from Bethel to Prince of Wales Island. We represent tribes and nonprofits, state governments, local governments, nonprofits, senior centers in and around the state. Last year, we started a public awareness campaign, and the first part of that was called the Good Going Alaska campaign. And one of the issues that we've run across a lot of our members has been to really kind of put, if you will, a human face to what is public and community transportation in our state. And these are some examples of some newspaper ads that we ran in Anchorage, in Fairbanks, and on the Kenai Peninsula that talk about what public transportation is. Systems statewide do about 7 million rides. And what I like to tell people is that each one of those rides is a story. It's a senior who is isolated in her home and wants to go to the senior center to play bingo. It's somebody newly employed that's got a job, that's taking a bus to get to work. It's a mom taking her kids to daycare. Each one of those rides is a story. And we tried through our campaign to talk about what those stories are. We gave you a link to our website so folks can check that out for more information. We also did a series of bus. We also did a series of bus ads, and this is Kevin Gadsey, who lives in Ketchikan, and these ads ran on buses all over the state and talks about why public transportation is important. This ad focuses on the importance of keeping Alaskans independent, living in their local communities and functionally independently. Finally, we also did a radio ad. We did several radio ads that played across the state. We're going to click on this real quick. It's should be able hopefully to hear it. Well, I guess it didn't work, so we'll go back. We did a we did a series of radio ads that kind of tied into the theme, and it really had local individuals talk about their stories, about why they take the bus and why public transportation is important. We had some folks in villages in the southeast talk about how it is, enables them to get to local events in their communities. We talked about people who use it to get to work. We had folks who live out in the Matsu Valley who talked about it, how they commute daily in between the Matsu Valley and in Anchorage. So it's a good ad, but you can access that on our website as well. But what we're here to talk about today is we have two legislative priorities. The first priority, I'm going to actually go to the next one, and we'll talk about this other one last. The first one is the Alaska Community and Public Transportation Advisory Board. And the photo that you see up there is of the new Juneau Transit Center, which I had the pleasure of taking a tour of earlier this month with Representative Munoz. And I want to thank her and Senator Egan for helping us with that tour. This was built with some ARRA money as well as local money in the city and borough of Juneau. And it's a parking garage and a transit center, and it's really going to help people. I take the bus when I'm here in Juneau, and I will tell you I stand outside a lot in the rain. And so it was very nice to come down here and have a place to under shelter and meet other bus riders and take the bus. And my understanding is coordinated with other transportation in the area too. So I applaud the city and borough of Juneau on a really good coordinated system. But the proposal that Senator Munoz has put forth, along with, I think, Representative Munoz, thank you, is to create a community and public transportation advisory board. And our position is that public and community transportation is very important in our state, and there really needs to be a role for the state of Alaska on how people move around our state. And so through the works of the representative and others, we feel like it's time to have a state voice in how community and public transportation is developed. And so HB 131 was introduced on Friday by Ms. Munoz, and I understand it's going to be coming before the Transportation and Finance Committee, and we strongly support it. The second bill that we're presenting, and I have to apologize, this PowerPoint was done before some changes were made, but I understand that the bill, the partnership in public transportation, is going to be coming through the Senate Transportation Committee. So I want to thank Senator Kokesh and his staff for helping to put this together. Alaska is one of only three states that does not provide operating funds for public transportation. So the burden has fallen on local communities. In the case of Kenai, that's a nonprofit. There are tribes that invest in public transportation. Local governments are investing in public transportation, senior centers, other folks. But the state of Alaska has not made that investment. And so in working with the senators, we feel strongly that it's time for the state of Alaska to be a partner in how public transportation is provided. So we appreciate the support of the Transportation Committee and look forward to its introduction, which I understand will be shortly, and be happy to work with the different committees on getting it done. And with that, my presentation is over. I had an amusing last photo for you. You want to click on that? You all work very hard, but sometimes this was actually in the Anchorage Daily News. Everybody takes the bus, including Moose. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them or turn it over to our next speaker.
Nice bowl, huh?
Yeah.
Any questions that anyone has? Seeing no questions, thank you very much for coming before us today and going over that. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to
Okay, Madam Chair.
Oh, yes.
Senator Kopich, committee members, I'll just echo David's sentiments. Again, I'm Jennifer Beckman with the Alaska Mobility Coalition. I'm the president of that, but really I kind of want to talk to you as the executive director of Central Area Transit. We're a small nonprofit organization that provides public transportation for the Central Kenai Peninsula. And we provide up to 60,000 rides per year. And the majority of our passengers are going back and forth to work, medical appointments, going to the doctor, support services that they may need in our community, shopping, recreational activities. But I have to echo David in saying that we would really like to see the state play a role in public transportation because we provide a very needed service in all of our communities for people that in some way, shape, or form have no other options than to rely on us for a ride to get to where they need to go and to help contribute to their community. So I would strongly urge you to invest in us because we're really doing good work out there. So thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for Jennifer? Okay, thank you very much. All right, we'll have just a brief at ease. Please don't leave anyone because this is just the next group is going to get set up.
Okay. Representative Wilson, my name is Bill Herman. I work for the Mental Health Trust Authority. It's nice seeing you again. I wanted to ask if it would be okay if Millie Ryan, she's the executive director of the Governor's Council on Disabilities, could share my time that I have. I'll keep my comments briefer and
right.
let her finish up, if that would be all right.
That'd be fine.
Okay. I'm here representing the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. We've been working on the coordinated transportation issue since the trust was formulated in 1995. We've been funding coordinated transportation since 1996. Every year we have a trust advocacy summit, and the two topics that we were picking as our prime topics to coalesce all of our various groups that represent the beneficiaries was one was Medicaid issues, and the other was this coordinated transportation issue. So this is a very high priority for us. I'm also the trust designee on the governor's coordinated transportation task force, too, and excited to be a part of that team and excited that the governor is interested in finding these efficiencies that coordinated transportation can provide. The specific type of coordinated transportation that the trust has been funding and interested in since 1996 is where we work with an agency within a community who is providing transportation for its customers, and you know, the service providers are doing this, and we have them coalesce around a coordinated system, and they take vans that are used that were used on an individual basis by individual agencies, pull them, and get a lot more efficient use out of the vehicles that they have to use. We find it very efficient. It's kind of a win-win situation for the state, for local government, and for the beneficiaries. They get more rides and works well. There's a lot of support for this type of transportation. David Levy's group, the Mobility Coalition, did a survey in 2009 and found that 94% of Alaskans supported transportation like this. I think there's an advantage. I'm excited to be on the task force because I think we can look across state government to different ways that rides are provided through various funding streams within state government and find ways, I hope, that we can find ways for more efficiencies and combined rides, combined funding sources to help this, what I call the rising tide that lifts all boats. Trust beneficiaries are about 5 to 8% of Alaskans, we estimate. That's the mentally ill, developmentally disabled, those with Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, and then chronic alcoholism. The transportation is key for their ability to be able to get to work and make their lives meaningful within their capacity. It helps them to get to their health care needs, and it also provides a quality of life improvement and hope in their life to make it meaningful. We've estimated with DOT's help that about 46% of the ridership in all of the transportation systems and our coordinated systems, 46% are trust beneficiaries. So we really rely heavily on this type of transportation. The trust has given about $5 million over the last 15 years or so. That's been matched with general funds along the way. We've given only capital dollars because some of you that are familiar with the Trust Authority, we try to use our money for catalysts for change and not pay for base operating budget. We oftentimes use our dollars to match Federal Transit dollars, Federal Transit Authority dollars, and make it possible for us to bring federal revenue in. And that's a very important, I think, help we have to the state. And then finally, with this estimated 46% of the rides, I know the Alaska Mobility Coalition has estimated about 7 million rides per year are provided through our various systems around the state. That's a lot of benefit to a lot of people, an economic benefit, too. And then Millie would make a comment or two, I think, along those lines. So that represents about 3.2 million rides that are just trust beneficiaries alone. So we're very much in favor of this operating subsidy that that is being considered now in the legislature. With that, maybe I could stop and let Millie speak for a few moments.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions for Bill? All right, Millie, go ahead.
Hey, I'm Millie Ryan, the Executive Director of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, and one of the founding members of the Alaska Mobility Coalition. The reason that the council's interested in transportation is that whenever we have public comment, we hold community forums, or we survey people with disabilities in the state, we learn that people find it hard to get to work, to get to medical appointments, to be part of the community. As a result, a lot of people end up very isolated and lonely. The 2010 Harris Poll, it's done annually, they survey people with and without disabilities, and they found that there are huge gaps between people with disabilities and people without disabilities in terms of socializing, in terms of getting to work, in terms of a whole host of things. But certainly transportation is a piece of what helps create that gap. The Transportation Equity Network did a study that shows that transportation is an economic driver and that it gets people to jobs, to shopping, medical, all the things where they might not only work but spend their money. Their study said that about almost $6 is of economic benefit is returned for every dollar spent on public transportation. The council supports the creation of a sustainable state transportation trust fund. And thank you, Representative Wilson and Senator Thomas, for introducing legislation to that effect, because we believe it will provide operating assistance, a sustainable source of funds for operations. And that truly is the difficult part of keeping transportation going. There are a number of different sources for capital funds to purchase the vehicles, but you actually then need to be able to run the vehicles, and that's where we do not have a good source of funds for operations at this point in time. Any questions?
Any questions? Don't see any. So let's have Jeff Otteson come on up, and he represents DOT. And Jeff, introduce yourself, and we would like to hear your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Otteson. I'm the Director of Program Development at Alaska DOT. And in that division is housed the transit, the rural transit program that DOT administers for the state. But I'm really here wearing a separate hat right now. If you recall, last February we presented to you that on the results of the Coordinated Transportation Task Force, the findings of that report, and one of the things we found out is that we really needed to do more work. And in July of last year, Governor Parnell reappointed the task force, added some new seats, and basically gave us the task of doing some more work and coming back eventually with a report to you. So that's what I'm here to give you, is just a very short update of what the Coordinated Transportation Task Force does. First, the members, you have a handout of the membership I think, before you in your packet. It's now a 12-member task force. There's 7 state members and 5 members from various transit and nonprofit organizations, and then another 4 members on the back that are ex officio, are non-voting. And then finally, there's 2 staff members to the commission. They're both in the audience. Marcia Brackey is our consultant, and Eric Taylor, my staff, if they just raise their hands. And you've already met 2 of the members of the task force. Bill Hermans was just before you, and prior to that, Jennifer Beckman, Camille Ferguson. I think Camille stepped out. And I don't know if there's anyone else in the room right now, but Camille is from Sitka, the Sitka Tribes of Alaska, and they run a transit program there. So just to speak briefly to the power of coordination. Coordination is the idea that the various nonprofits and organizations that are providing transit service should work in unison, should work in concert, so you don't end up with vans going up and down the road carrying a fraction of these people that need transportation. And you know, if you're a senior, you can't ride in the van that's for handicapped people, et cetera. You don't want that. It's so powerful that President Bush signed an executive order that basically said there should be coordination among the federal agencies, and they should be tasked with trying to coordinate. And the reason is, in the federal budget, there are 60 different types of transportation funding found. And that a lot of that money moves into the state government and ends up in different departments of state government. And so you end up with state government being tasked then with working to see that coordination actually happens, hence the membership you see on the task force. It's the idea that we should do things more efficiently and at the same time make transportation more possible for the people that need it. And just to give you one anecdote of how important this is, we've heard stories in our first round of meetings of people in rural Alaska having to get into a major city for a medical appointment, and they're in a wheelchair, and they arrive at their airport in the big city, and they can't get a wheelchair accessible transportation provider, and so they end up using an ambulance, which of course gets billed to government ultimately in some way, shape, or form. And that's how they get to their medical appointment, and that's how they get to the hotel where they spend the night. And you think about the cost, it's just really alarming. So there's some real power here, and there's some real savings to be found that would show up in all these different budgets and all these different sources of funding. So I've told you what transportation is. Here's a few other facts to be aware of. Alaska has one of the fastest growing senior populations in the nation. A lot of us came here in the 70s, and we're now reaching our senior citizen years. We also have one of the highest per capita number of veterans in the nation. So we have a very high level of veterans. Many of those have needs as they grow older or because they have injuries from their time in the military. I've already spoken to the fact that there are 60 different federal funding sources. But you really need to have some mechanism for these organizations to basically ensure that coordination happens. It's very easy for people to fall back into their individual task, their individual nonprofit, their individual organization, and not think holistically or globally. So we're at the stage right now where we are gathering data. One of the shortcomings we had last time is getting a real good handle on how many people need to be addressed. And the problem is partially that you have a lot of overlap between groups. You may have a senior who's also disabled, so you end up with the person being double counted on 2 agencies' lists. So we're trying to get through that and get down to a more correct number. We're also looking to do a needs assessment process so we can scope the need for just how many people, where they live, what types of needs they have. And I think with that, I'll close unless there's any questions. But the task force has a duty to come back to you a year from now with another report. And we have 3 more. We have a meeting this week, tomorrow in Juneau. We have meetings planned in May in Fairbanks, in July in Kodiak, and in October in Anchorage. And so we'll be wrapping up by the end of this year and reporting back at the next session.
Would you repeat when those meetings are again?
May 3rd, Fairbanks. July 28th in Kodiak, and October 24th in Anchorage.
Thank you very much. Jeff, how many different areas did you say where there's, in different parts of state government, how many different areas are there where there's transportation?
Well, the money flows to agencies like Department of Labor, Department of Built Military and Veterans Affairs, certainly Department of Health and Social Services. Bill Herman talked about it. The Mental Health Trust Authority has clients that they're serving. So you end up with federal programs passing money down. Federal transit money comes to DOT, and we've been encouraged to encourage coordination at the local level, and have been doing so for over a decade. And actually, Alaska has a pretty good track record in coordination, but we have by no means covered the entire state.
Right. Senator Thomas has a question.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Do you have a protocol for the study regarding the demand or the need?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I'm not sure you know the protocol. We do have a scope of work. We do have an outline of tasks that we're working on, and we have an outline of tasks that was actually set out in the governor's proclamation that established the task force.
And you have a timeline for completing the study?
Yes, we do.
And that is?
It's the exact date is to be delivered to the governor January of 2012.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other Representative Feige?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. It seems that one of your basic functions is coordinating all these different entities, but it seems to be the coordination is between other government entities for the most part.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, it's our role at DOT is to work at the local level with whoever's providing transportation, be that a nonprofit for seniors or a local transit authority, and try to get them to work together. And in some cases, we've had very good success where they're actually sharing a dispatch, they're sharing maintenance, they're sharing vehicle ownership. So they actually, though they each have different groups of clients they worry about, they're letting the transportation piece of their organization be done for a larger group of people.
How much coordination is done then, not only with these other governmental organizations, but with private transportation entities like taxi cab services, limousines, and like your example of using the ambulance to get back and forth to the airport, it would seem there's handicapped vans that are available. It's just if they were coordinated, we could reduce the cost of these services.
Through the chair, absolutely. That is exactly the type of issues we've been discussing in our first report and we'll continue to look at. Is there a way that we can incentivize a taxi cab company? What we hear from them often is that it's a lot of money to own the van. We don't get enough use for it to justify the cost. And so you get a little pushback for those reasons. So we have to find a way to make that van available when it's needed. And we're looking at ways to do that.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff. And now we will take another little break and so that we can get set up for the next group. And now we'll have the Port McKenzie Rail Extension group. We have Elizabeth Gray, the acting Matsu Borough Manager, and Rick Meistrom, the project consultant. He's online. And Joe Perkins is the project executive. So who's going to go first, but if you just announce yourselves and state your affiliation, we will proceed.
Hello. Good afternoon, and I would like to thank each of you for taking the time to listen to us today as we present our number one priority for the Matsu Borough, the Port Mac Rail Extension. Thank you, co-chairs Kukesh and Wilson, as well as the whole Transportation Committee. I have several people joining us today. First, we have members of the railroad in the audience, the Alaska Railroad, who is our partner on this project. Tom Brooks is the vice. My name is Elizabeth Gray, acting borough manager for the Matsu Borough. We have Tom Brooks, the railroad vice president of engineering, and Wendy Linskug, vice president of government affairs. Also, Brad Swartz, our transportation planner, is with us today. As you mentioned, on my right is Joe Perkins, who is former DOT commissioner and our project executive. And on the phone is former Anchorage Mayor Rick Meistrom, who is our economic development advisor on this project. We'd really like to thank you for your support last session. We garnered $35 million from that support that you gave us last year. And we really appreciate your time as we ask for your continued support on this most important project to the statewide economy. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Mayor Maestrom, who's with us via teleconference.
Okay, thank you very much, Elizabeth. That was a lot of confidence you had. You didn't know if I'd be on the phone and say anything when you introduced me. Good for you. My name is Rick Maestrom. I know most of you folks, and former mayor of Anchorage, and working with the Mat-Su Borough, I have been working with them the last 2 years on this project. First, what we're going to do is show you a five-minute video, and then we'll give you an overview of the project, and then I'll come back on and give about a five-minute summary of the economic impact and of the rail extension. So let's go right into it. We'll first start with the video. I think that's probably ready to go.
There's uncertainty about the gas line construction. We don't know if that's going to happen. There's uncertainty about energy availability and costs. There's uncertainty about the future of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. It's down to about 600,000 barrels a day, and the shutdown point is about 300,000 barrels a day. There's uncertainty about the Small Business Administration contracting program for Alaska Native Corporations. And there's uncertainty about the exploration permits for the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea. But there's two things we know for sure that are not uncertain. One is we have a lack of diversification in our Alaskan economy. And two, we have a lack of transportation infrastructure needed to promote economic development. But the solution to those last two is underway right now. And that is the rail extension from the main line of Alaska Railroad to Port McKenzie. This is one of the most significant parts of the Port McKenzie development, and that is a rail loop. This is a 110-car rail loop. Most mineral aggregate trains have 100 cars. And so a 100-car train can come down here, make the turn, come onto the loop. There's no coupling, there's no backup, there's no unhitching. The train just keeps moving, and it's a very efficient way to unload product. Now, here's what's going on this summer. You'll see some of the things that have happened. This area back up here is where the loop that I just talked about is going to be. That's going to pull across, circle around here, pull across here, and come right down onto the port. This is the work that's been done this summer on the barge dock, and the barge dock will be used for staging, for modules, for pipe, for a lot of product going up to the North Slope. You can see the magnitude of this project. With this fellow standing there, you can see the pilings in the background that they have there. Here is the work that was done this summer. Ships come in and ships go out. The main part of the work is done on the rail extension itself, moving and connecting the Alaska Railroad main line to Port McKenzie. This is the work that's been done this summer and is going on, and you'll see in a minute the result of all this work. Here's a good overview of what's happened. Over in this area is the rail loop coming in. We have along here the rail bed that's going to be going north to connect to the main line of the Alaska Railroad. You'll get an idea of the size of this work and the amount of work that's taken place here. You can see the small trucks in the lower right-hand side of your screen, or the big trucks, I guess, in the lower right-hand side of your screen that look very, very small on that large road bed. It's both a road bed and it will be a railroad bed, too. It's going to be going north from this point, circling around, and you see the amount of bed that's been created. From there, it goes north on up to the main line of the Alaska Railroad and on up through Keeley, Denali, and Fairbanks up toward Light and Good and Delta. Now, once again, the key to this is the movement down of all of these products. And we've got people who have these resources. They would like to develop them. They're very excited about this project. And it would be from, and all of those diamonds represent various deposits that are in that area. There's a new opportunity now with Delta Junction. That rail has been approved. It's going to be built by the federal government. That will extend from Delta Junction to Fairbanks. and then from Fairbanks all the way down through the extension to Port McKenzie. From Port McKenzie, it's unloaded, put on board the ship, and from there it goes to Incheon, Shanghai, and Yokohama. Very simple, very straight, very clean, very efficient, and very inexpensive.
Okay, what I'm going to do now is just give about a 5-minute summary of what kind of impact this will have on the Alaskan economy, and then I'm going to turn it over to Joe Perkins to give a report on the status of the project and where we are right now. So first of all, with this project, if you would pull out the sheets that you have in the back pocket of your three-ring binder, in the back pocket there is about a 15-page just graphics, and I'm going to go over those in 5 minutes very quickly. So if you can follow along, I think that would help. So first of all, what the rail extension does is it opens up the interior to resource development. It creates a development corridor along the rail belt for the exploration and extraction of strategic minerals, primarily lead, zinc, copper, molybdenum, and silver. It also facilitates the development of a world-class limestone deposit between Livengood and Fairbanks. And there is a limestone deposit in Livengood that is so large that it could provide 15% of America's cement needs for the next 200 years. And in addition to that, that limestone deposit up near Livengood could provide all the cement needed for the Susitna Dam if that project goes. So that's where the cement for the Susitna Dam would come from if that project goes. If you go to page 2, the next page in that handout, it also facilitates the development of a cement production facility in or near Fairbanks. And this is where the cement for Susitna Dam and cement for export would be manufactured. The next point down is it dramatically improves the world competitiveness of Alaskan coal. The Usabelli folks right now are exporting 1 million tons a year through the Port of Seward. They will continue to export that through the Port of Seward. They have no plans to change that. But Seward is maxed out from their standpoint. They estimate that they will add 3 million tons to their exports. It will go from 1 million tons to a total of 4 million tons. 3 million of those tons will be exported along the rail extension down to Port McKenzie. It also significantly reduces the transportation and staging costs for the Alaska Gas Pipeline construction. Exxon has estimated it would save about $100 million in terms of gas pipeline construction. The pipe comes in 40-foot sections. It would be welded in Port McKenzie, coated, and put on 90-foot, welded into 80-foot sections, put onto 90-foot railroad cars. And so that dramatically, all of that increases the employment in the Mat-Su Borough, Denali Borough, and the Fairbanks North Star Borough. Now, how does this work? It's Port McKenzie and the rail extension working together. Port McKenzie, this is very important, is a bulk commodities port primarily for the export of minerals, cement, and coal. It does provide for the import and storage and staging of bulk fuel and pipe and modules for big things. It's not a consumer goods, it's not a commodities import like the Port of Anchorage. It's not a container port. So the Port of Anchorage and Port McKenzie work together and complement each other. They don't take away from each other at all. If you go to the next page, page 4 in that handout, you can see the dramatic difference in what we're looking at. We're looking at 14 square miles of industrial land in the Port McKenzie area. That is the industrial center. What you're looking at right now is the industrial center for all of South Central Alaska in the future. That 14 square miles is a lot more room than we have any place else in the state. If you look down at the Port of Anchorage, you can see that we don't have that kind of space in the Port of Anchorage. If you go to the next page, it talks about the advantages of rail to Port McKenzie. One, it's shorter rail distance to tidewater for mineral exports, 147 miles closer than any other opportunity to get into tidewater. It's the only Alaskan port with a 100-car rail loop, in fact, the only Alaska port who could create a 100-car rail loop. It's very efficient product transfer from train to ship, and it avoids the most congested part of the Alaska Railroad main line. And especially in the summer, the most congested part is around Anchorage. It avoids that and goes straight to Tidewater. It's a deep water port that operates year round. It's a 60-foot port compared to a 39-foot minimum low tide port that Anchorage is. Port McKenzie is 60 feet, and that allows the biggest ships in the world to come into Port McKenzie, ships that cannot come in to the port of Anchorage, the ships that are needed to carry mineral aggregate. Thus, now go to the next page, page 6. I mentioned the 14 square miles of industrial area. It makes Alaska's minerals much more competitive on the world market, especially molybdenum, copper, lead, zinc, and coal, all that require heavy movement of aggregate. And also, this gives us a great opportunity, of course, to grow our export economy. If you look at the next page, that shows our total export economy. That's page 7 I'm on right now. We're up to $4 billion a year, in 2006-2007. We dropped down the past 3 years, and that wasn't the function of anything that we did or didn't do or that the state of Alaska did or didn't do. It was the world economy. 2010, our export economy is projected, and it's just, and it's pretty certain right now, they've got it to be back up to $4.2 billion. But we have the opportunity now to grow that dramatically. The next page, page 8, just gives you an idea of what our total exports are. Seafood's our biggest total export, 50%. But the minerals are 26%, and that's where the great opportunity for growth is in minerals. If you go to the next page, you look at the customers we have. Japan's our biggest customer. They're a resource-poor country. They need these materials, and only 14% of our exports to Japan right now are minerals, and that can increase dramatically. On page 10 shows our second biggest customer is China. Only 15% of the export to China right now is minerals. And while China has in its interior a lot of minerals, they have no infrastructure in there, no roads, no rails in their interior to get those minerals developed. It's much cheaper for them to buy their minerals from Alaska than it is to try to develop the whole isolated and desolate interior of China. Our last customer, our third customer, is Korea. They're already importing 35% of their imports is in minerals, and that's a reflection of the large amount of coal imports that are going to Korea right now. Again, another resource-poor country that will continue to import from Alaska. On page 12, it talks about the jobs that are estimated by two groups, the Institute for Social and Economic Research, ICER, and HDR, which is a company, and I don't know what HDR stands for, but they just go by HDR. It's estimated that the construction of Port McKenzie and the rail extension will create 3,000 jobs. That's their projection from construction. But more important is the ongoing private development jobs that will be created. It's estimated by these same two groups that the mining development along the rail line will create 4,000 ongoing continuous private sector jobs, and that the industrial development of Port McKenzie, and this is over a long period of time, I think they're looking at 17 years is what they estimated, but the industrial development from Port McKenzie will create about 3,500 jobs. And that is the major ongoing jobs. So we're talking about 7,500 jobs over the next 10 to 15 to 17 years based on these two groups. Now, before I turn it over to Joe Perkins, what I'd just like to say is that this year what we need to continue on, and this is a project that is on schedule and it's under budget, and what we need to continue on is $55 million. This year the governor included $20 million in his budget, which was a lot better than last year. There was nothing included in his budget last year, but the legislature put in $57 million, and $22 million was vetoed, but $35 million last year stayed in from the governor's budget. This year, to stay on schedule and on budget, actually under budget, we need $55 million. So that will be our discussion with the folks in the legislature over the next 2 months. So with that said, what I'd like to do is turn it over to Joe Perkins to talk about pages 14 and 15 and tell you where we are right now on the project. Joe?
Thank you, Rick. I'm Joe Perkins, the executive project project manager for this project. The slide we show on page 14 shows three numbers, and those were three appropriations that the legislature has made to this project. The first appropriation, which was about 4 years ago, was $10 million, and it was to complete the EIS. And the EIS right now is almost completed. We expect it to be issued, the final EIS, in March. The EIS is being done by a federal agency, the Surface Transportation Board, out of Washington, D.C. We pay for all of it, but they do all of the work. We really have no say in it other than paying for the work that they do. But that portion, the $10 million, is going to be adequate to complete the EIS. The next appropriation was $17 million, which we have utilized for construction of the rail loop that was shown on the slides. And this rail loop is sitting right at 70% complete. We contracted out $10 million worth of construction contracts that will be completed. The last contract will be completed this next summer. The remainder of that money we have committed to doing design and the various other project activities, environmental and so on. Then last year we received appropriation which ended up at $35 million. At $35 million we'll fund the first of the construction contracts for the embankment on the main rail extension line. And that'll do approximately 5 to 6 miles a line, contract somewhere around $22 or $23 million. We have that designed. We have the right of way within a month of settling it, and we will be awarding the first contract for this as soon as we get the EIS. And the reason we're waiting on the EIS is the EIS will determine the exact route. There's three potential routes. The route of this rail line will be selected by the feds within the EIS that the Surface Transportation Board will issue the final on, hopefully in March. So you notice that this total $62 million that has been committed to date for this project by the state. And again, we need $55 million and to continue to stay on schedule. Of that $55 million, $50 million of it will be construction contracts. We are ready to go with construction contracts on embankment as soon as we get the EIS and as soon as we get more money. So we would like to see that increased from $20 to $55 million.
And with that, I would like to, I'm Elizabeth Gray again. With that, I would ask that you turn to the first page of your three ring binder. And just want to thank you again very much and remind you that full funding of this project right now makes sense. The project will create thousands of construction and mining jobs. The market for Alaska's minerals are ready. The Port McKenzie Rail can provide most of the construction materials for the Susitna Dam through our port. And when the natural gas pipeline gets underway, shipping heavy materials through the Port McKenzie area saves the state project $100 million over other ports. Bids are coming in lower than estimated given the downturn in the economy, so it really just makes perfect sense to fund this project now. With that, I'd like to thank you very much for your time and attention as we seek your further support on this project.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Thomas.
You'll get used to that when we have a judge. Thank you for your presentations. I realize you weren't the ones that created the studies, but I'd like to know a little bit more about, and since I'm from the interior, I'm somewhat familiar with the various mines that exist, but we have a pretty ambitious number for the amount of mines and the employment with them. Can you kind of list those mines, which ones you anticipate coming online in the time frame that the railroad, that this link would be added?
We'll be happy to give you a listing of that information, but we have heavy interest from coal mining, which is Usabelli, who would like to open up further their development. We've also gotten interest from copper mines, and as you're aware, some of these entities request confidentiality, but we'll be happy to get your list of the ones that we've got available.
I think that would be helpful because obviously if you're going to convince people this is something that you need to do, you need to have those details to simply claim that this will happen is difficult, and I understand, but I've grown weary of the word proprietary in our discussions here in Juneau with particularly the oil industry. In line with that, what's the difference in mileage again? Remind me from going to Point McKenzie versus going to Seward or into Anchorage.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, the difference is about 10.
Name, please.
Joe.
About 147 miles shorter, Senator, than if it has to go to Seward. So about 147 miles difference, and that makes a huge difference because mineral export, there was just a seminar I attended that said mineral export is transportation is mineral export. So it's 147 miles closer to Port McKenzie than it would be if it had to get out of Seward.
And that was Rick Meisem. So why would that not divert the existing coal that's going to Seward, especially with some of the difficulty that they're having at that Seward port with having to protect against the wind and the coal dust, et cetera?
You know, that
Rick Meisem.
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. This is Rick Meisem. That's a question, really, that Usabelli would have to answer. What they have told me a number of times is that with Port McKenzie, they will not, they will continue the same amount of coal through Seward, and it could very well have to do with the relationship with Seward or the existing investment in structure they have there. So I don't know exactly why they continue doing that other than the relationship with Seward and existing infrastructure, but that's what their commitment, or that's what they've said to me.
And one last, if I may.
A follow-up, Senator Thomas.
Thank you. The last page says what's next and has the 156. Is that anticipated to be finished project connecting the rail into Point McKenzie? No other infrastructure needed? No other numbers floated in the future? Another page next year that says there's another $50 million needed because something at the port facility was not put in place with this money, anything like that? So this is the final number?
Through the chair. Mr. Thomas, that is correct. That is an estimated cost of the final completion of this project in total to the Alaska Railroad main line.
And follow up. Just one more. There was discussion.
Can I respond to Senator Thomas? I'd like to respond to Senator Thomas. Was that Senator Thomas's question?
It was.
Go ahead, Rick Meisem.
Thank you very much, Senator. Somebody had asked earlier in one of the earlier presentations about you're tired of hearing projects that are over budget or that don't perform the way they do. And this is one project that's coming in under budget. It initially started out at about a $290 million project, then went down to $250 million. Now it's at $218 million because the budgets are coming in so slow, and we've had no big barriers yet. So we really do believe that this will be a $218 million project, down about $70 million from the initial estimates.
We appreciate that. And my last question is along the lines of you indicated spurs going from Fairbanks to Delta and spurs going to Livengood. The completion and success of this project is not based on those, I hope.
It is not. The Delta issue, we just added to it because the federal government has funded that, but there are some challenges, I think, with some river crossings there. The Livengood, any extension from Fairbanks to Livengood is not included in this and would probably be triggered by the sit in the dam if that goes. It's not necessary, but it would be an improvement if it was extended to Livengood, but that's not included in this budget.
I see the railroad is real happy here that they find out from you that the spur to Delta has been funded by the federal government. Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Madam Chairwoman.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you. Number one, thanks for the presentation by Matsuburo. I'd just like to impress upon us that this is a statewide project, not a Matsuburo project. And this is just kind of connecting the dots to a piece of it. And, you know, the beneficiary, I mean, quite frankly, a number of my constituents are not happy about some aspects of this because it disrupts their lifestyle, much like was mentioned by Government Hill. And some, but it's important to the state, and I support it by virtue of that with some grief from constituents. On the other hand, I think that the borough has both verbally and in writing support that they have received from other communities, and I would just like you to share that with us, if you would.
Yes, sir, through the chair to Senator Huggins. We have on tab 4 resolutions of support from numerous entities, including the Denali Borough, Alaska Railroad Corporation, Alaska Miners Association, the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, Matanuska-Susitna Borough, Greater Wasilla Chamber of Commerce, City of Palmer, and the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, and they've listed as their top infrastructure priority.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairwoman.
Okay, thank you. Does the railroad have any comments that they would like to present? All right. Thank you, everyone, for coming today and helping us learn more about the different transportation issues. If we could just do all of them that were even mentioned, it would be wonderful. So, thank you very much. And I do want to say that this coming Thursday, the House will not be having a transportation meeting at all this coming Thursday. However, we will be meeting jointly again on February 8th to listen to presentations by DOT and MTAB on the Alaska Marine Highway. So having Senator...
The Senate will be meeting on Thursday, and we're going to have one bill before us. It'll be at 1 o'clock in the Senate Transportation Room, if we have one. In the Butchrich. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, and we will stand adjourned at 2:38.
Thank you again.